From the studios of KPCW in Park City, Utah, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning, we are speaking first with guest Bree Groff, a change expert and the author of a delightfully bold new book called Today Was Fun, a book about work, seriously, in which we talk a lot about how the workplace can and should be fun and how it really improves the bottom line instead of distracting or being playful for just fun reasons. Then we speak with Heather Clark, author of The Scrapbook, which has been described by Booklist as a Sally Rooney novel merged with a Richard Linklater film with forays into history and humanity, further deepening the experience. It's a wonderful book and a wonderful interview with Heather Clark coming up second in the second part of our hour. We'll be right back after a few words from our sponsors. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Today we're talking about something most of us do nearly every day, yet rarely reflect on with joy. That is work.
Our guest is Bree Groff, a change expert, organizational designer, and now the author of a delightfully bold new book, Today Was Fun, a book about work, seriously. With humor, insight, and a touch of rebellion, Bree takes aim at the outdated, joyless models of work that leave so many of us drained, while offering a fresh vision of what it means to find purpose, play, and actual fun in our professional lives.
This isn't about beanbags or office perks. It's about designing workplaces and work days that people actually want to be a part of, whether you're a leader trying to build a better culture or an employee wondering why fun feels like a dirty word at the office. Bree Groff is here to shift the conversation. Bree Groff, welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, about 15 years ago, all the cool workplaces seemed to be in a perks competition. They had smoothie bars and open concept layouts and napping pods. And I will admit, it really did sound like a lot of fun. But you've said that fun at work is not about ping pong tables or perks, and the trends seem to have reflected that in the years since COVID for people who've returned to a physical office. So if a fun workplace is not about ping pong or creature comforts, what is it about?
Ah, well, great question. First of all, thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here. And yeah, I think of those kinds of things as like icing on the work cake. You know, icing is delicious. I'm a fan. I love a happy hour, love a ping pong table, but you can't live your life on icing. And like the cake of work, the actual substance of what you're doing every day, who you're around, what are you creating? What impact is it having? That all can be genuinely fun as well. Because when we boil down what work is, it's just creating some value for others. That's it. We're using some skills. We're making something others appreciate. A lot of that is exchanged for money then. There's nothing about creating value that's fundamentally painful. The pain comes from all the things we put around work. Oh, you have to wear the suits and you have to make the presentations that look like X or Y or Z. So the cake of work can be fun too. And that's what I'm on a mission to share. So certainly, you know, have the ping pong tables. I enjoy a good game of ping pong, but also we have to ask ourselves, what are people doing day in and day out? Are they enjoying the people they're spending their days with? And if not, that's where we need to put our focus.
Sure. And I appreciated you have a quote early in the book that says there's an old Norwegian response to the question of how are you that basically translates to up and not crying. And so it's so funny yeah. that, you know, this can feel pretty relevant about work sometimes. Do you think that not having fun at work is sometimes just a habit or something that people are in the habit of saying, even if they don't actually feel that way?
Yeah. Yes. So I do love that. I'm butchering the Norwegian, but it's oppe og ikke gråter, something like that. Yeah. It's how are you? I'm up and not crying. So that is in the book as a nod to like most work, most days should be fun. That's the title of chapter one. Unlike some of the lessons you might hear about, you know, work needs to be your passion and your life's calling. I think that's far too high a bar. That's exhausting. And it also doesn't need to be that way in order for us to enjoy our jobs. So I'm a big fan of, are you having fun most days at work? Like, great. Okay, you're doing a really good job. So I think there's ways for us to expect that we have a good day at work without holding ourselves to unrealistic standards. So a lot of people, I think, go into work assuming, oh, work is called work for a reason. I'm not supposed to have fun, right? That's why they pay me. No, they pay you because you create value. The pain is optional. But I think if we can shift our mindset a little bit to say, I expect to have fun at work today, it opens up the possibilities for how we design our days. So I give the example, you know, like maybe you need to do some expense reports for work. Well, you could do that hunched over your desk in your fluorescent lighting quietly, and you know, and it gets it done. Or you can say to a colleague next to you who also has to do expense reports, like, hey, do you want to like go to the park, like sit on the bench outside? Should we grab some lattes, put a little music on in the background? The expense reports get done either way. But the mindset that we bring to work of like, if I expect this to be fun, now I'm looking for ways to make it social and invigorating and like something I want to do with my day.
Oh, this is great too. As you're talking, Bree, all these questions are coming into my mind about why we work and how we consider productivity and purpose and passion and all of that. And I wanted to say, because I'm sort of getting to this other end of my work life where lots of my peers are retiring and lots of friends are retiring. And I think it makes you reflect back on this whole work life that you've had, and you want to look at, you know, I mean, you look at what was so good about it, what gave you identity, what gave you purpose, what made you feel relevant. And I'm just wondering, are there just some bottom lines about reminders that we need throughout the day to say, like, why am I doing this? I'm doing this because it matters, because as you said in the beginning, because I'm helping, was it, I'm helping other people, or you said something like that.
Yeah. You know, and I think there's so many ways for us to enjoy our careers or to have fun at work in a given day. So you mentioned one, which I think is wonderful. Like this is important because I'm creating some value for somebody. I'm making someone else's day better. But that's one. There's also so many more. You know, I think of the show The Office, the sitcom. You know, they were in paper sales. They were not revolutionizing anybody's lives, but they were still having fun because for them, of the people, they made their own fun. And I also think it's a legitimate way to enjoy your job if mostly you're there to hang out with people you like, and as a byproduct, you're creating some value. It could also be that you love the mentorship. It could be that you love the creative process. It could be that you love, you know, keeping things tidy, and maybe you're an accountant and everybody, you know, counts on you for that. I find it so useful to diversify our thinking around where you could find joy at work from. And when there's so many more places to get joy from, it's so much easier to find it.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Bree Groff. She's talking to us about our jobs and how we should be able to find fun in them. Her book is called Today Was Fun. It's a book about work, seriously. I love the cover of your book, by the way. That is just,
thank you.
Just cute. A big, happy smile. One of those yellow, happy faces, but it's bigger than that somehow. Are there a few things that we must feel before we can feel joy, like that we need to feel like we're making a difference, we need to feel like we're appreciated, or if those things are absent, can we still feel joy, and should we, can we turn it around somehow?
Yeah, I think there's very little in terms of I must feel this in order to have fun at work. So for example, you know, The Office, we talked about, like, those people were not like, I'm making an impact through paper sales, but it was fine, you know, because they had the people there. you don't even necessarily like to have to like the people, although I'm a big fan of it. Maybe you just like creating the work that you do, whether you're a marketing manager or a nurse or whatever it may be. What I guess to answer your question, if there's anything that needs to be foundational to having a good day at work, I think it's that you still need to feel like a version of yourself at work. And so often we put on our business masks or we try and be presentable or palatable in a way that we fit in with the normative business culture around us. That I find always has a negative detriment, has a detriment to our experience of work because now we are shielding our humanity. We're having that experience where we're about to go to work and we like button ourselves up and try to be who we think we need to be. And at the end of the day, we, finally, I can be a human. So that's what I think about and write about a lot. How do we bring more humanity back into the workplaces such that we can feel like ourselves? And when we feel like ourselves, it's so much easier to enjoy ourselves. That I think is a prerequisite.
How much do you feel the responsibility for having fun, or even the possibility of having fun, is driven by the employees themselves or the leadership and the bosses? Does it have to come from the top down, or can employees themselves shift a vibe and make it more fun at work?
In a perfect world, it's both, right? You have leaders who are like, this, I care about the experience of my people's days and lives beyond them creating value for the business. Like, I just care about them because they're humans that I spend time with. But even in the absence of that, 1,000% people can create their own fun. I actually spend most of my time thinking about and writing about what is that local experience of your days at work, which is usually driven by your immediate team. So let's say you are in a you're a marketing manager and you've got five people around you who you generally work with most. Well, the CEO could be making this decision or that decision, whatever return to office there is, or that strategy. You know, ideally the things that the CEO and executives do helps you love your days. But even despite that, you can create a very cozy team and have your own fun, make your own fun, even with the few people around you, because ultimately that's generally how we experience work. We experience work through the lens of who are the people that I talk to most during the day? What are the things that I am myself and producing and doing every day? And then what's that vibe? You know, even your local manager has a disproportionate impact on your experience of work. So if anything, that's the relationship to focus on. And then you yourself as a manager, if you manage people, then you know, you make the weather. You can create a really cozy team environment despite anything else that's going on.
You make the weather. I like that. You've led change at some major organizations. Are there any consistent patterns that you tend to see in companies that are able to make work genuinely enjoyable?
Yeah, you know, I mean, speaking of leadership, it really does help when leaders are showing up authentically. And this has been written about like left, right, and center for like authentic leadership and communication. But I can't tell you, especially during change, how many leaders want to run every talking point through internal comms and like polish it to no end. And then this some kind of change announcement comes out. And then everybody's like, what? Like, what are they saying? Like, it's just a bunch of like corporate gobbledygook. Like, we're gonna double down on our strategic advantages in order to outperform for our customers. And you're like, wait, am I fired? Like, I don't know. So I understand that instinct because executives are often doing some kind of like risk avoidance dance. But ultimately, the changes that always go best are the ones in which the leaders are showing their own humanity. And in doing so, are giving permission to everybody else in the organization to share their actual experience. So if a CEO is like, we are going to do this X, Y, and Z strategy and off we go. Well, if that feels very formal, now you've just driven all the conversation into a grapevine in DMs. Wait, what is happening? Like, are they changing teams? What are resources? And that's not what you want. Like, what you want as a leader is to have, you don't want any grapevine. You just want people sharing their experience of change. And so in my time coaching leaders and working with leaders, it's about how can you create a sense of we're in it together and not I'm doing this change to you. Because people don't mind change, as they say, they mind being changed. And so it's that sort of a approach that makes the difference to how people receive it.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Well, Bree, you're a transformation expert and you've been an advisor to some really big companies like Microsoft, Google, Target, Calvin Klein, Hilton. So you've been doing this a long time in some really serious capacities. Can you encapsulate what you think that we're missing that led you to want to write a book about how to find joy in work? I mean, it's not enough to say, oh, because it's joyless, but what are we doing wrong as in our approach to work? Or what wrong is being done to us to make us not find joy?
Yeah. So for a book with an oversized neon smiley face on the front, there's actually quite a lot of existential dread in the book, I will say. And here's why. For me, the genesis of writing the book, I had my own life experience that sort of threw me into the gauntlet. My mother was diagnosed with a terminal cancer in 2022. I took leave from work to care for her until she passed away later that year. My father already had Alzheimer's. It was 9 months where I was constantly in cancer hospitals with her, constantly thinking about what's the prognosis, how many days, weeks, months. It was so gut-wrenching to know that the oncologists were performing modern miracles to give not only my mom more days, but everyone there at the cancer hospital as many days as possible. It became very obvious to me the value of a day when you see all these people yearning for more days. And then I check in with a friend at work who's like, oh, I just want it to be Friday. When can this week be over? And that contrast felt jarring. Like, oh, at work, we are wishing away our days. We are actually saying, I wish I didn't have Wednesday. I wish I didn't have to live Thursday. I wish I didn't have to live Friday. So that what we can then go live 2/7 of our lives. And so that it felt like an emergency in a way that I hadn't quite seen before. Because how common is it that we say like, oh, TGIF, or like, I can't wait for the weekend, you know? I don't judge anybody for saying that. It's just sort of like how work sometimes warps our brains. Because if we start with the premise that work is painful, then of course you'd want to skip through the pain. You know, we just want to endure it to get to the good part. But having had that experience and then having learned what I learned about it's the fact that it's possible to have a good day, you can lead that way, you can show up at work expecting to have a good day and make it ever more true, made me feel like, oh, this is a book I need to write and this is some lessons that I want to share.
And the book itself is funny. It's fun. Like your voice is very entertaining and irreverent in a way that you don't get very often in business books. And it's more than about business. It's really about humanity, as you've mentioned a few times. And what role does vulnerability and humanity and just seeing each other as people rather than metrics, what role does that play in our ability to have fun at work?
Oh, the biggest role. So yeah, in the book, I just tried to show up as myself. You know, my editor was like, there's kind of a lot of swearing, Brie. I'm like, it's fine. The people are going to think it's fine. Yeah, I mean, there's a crossword puzzle in the book. I was like, I just wrote how I spoke, but it felt important. It felt important to model that in the book because like, who was I going to be writing a book about fun, only like citing sources and writing in my most businessy? It was like, no, okay, this just needs to be human. Because that I think is the source of all fun at work. Like when we think about what's fun, I think about a moment where something has excited me, like a new idea, a new friendship, a new possibility. That excitement is extremely human. And one, some might say, not that professional. And when we think of professional, we think of like buttoned up, serious, not smiling. That is the opposite of a squeal. You know, like those two things don't normally go together. So when I think about what does it take to have fun at work, that sense of humanity, I think, is the very, very first step, which is why whenever I lead a team, we always do things like a check-in at the top of a stand-up, which is just a very simple, how are you on a scale of 1 to 5? Let's share once around. It's no more than just simply saying, how are you, and listening. You know, it's like, it's not an innovation, but still somehow it feels radical within business, because business feels, well, as you were saying, it feels so functional. Like you, colleague, are a means of me getting my work done, as a means of supporting this metric, as opposed to like, oh no, this is how we're spending our lives. And like, if we're spending our lives together, like I kind of like to like you, you know, so how can we make that possible?
That makes me wonder if this next generation of workers, if they're approaching things differently than past generations. It seemed like they have, millennials forward seem to have a different concept of how important the work-life balance is, and how much they're enjoying their job really matters, how much they're seen. Their identity isn't only that I'm an accountant. It's not only that I work for this company. It's a more holistic form of just recognizing yourself as a person. Do you see that? Is that something we can be hopeful about?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I myself am considered an elder millennial, I guess a term I'll wear proudly. Yeah, I am a big fan of the trend towards being more human at work. And I know like there will always be a kids these days attitude, which I like, oh, so not serious. And like, look at those ripped jeans and all of that. But I think on the whole, no matter what generation someone falls in, I believe, well, two things. One, people do want to be seen for themselves. Not that you have to bring your whole personality and self to work if you don't want to, but people genuinely want to be seen and appreciated for who they are. And two, people do genuinely want to have more than work in their lives. And I think, you know, in decades past, so now that I'm like almost 2 decades now into the workforce, I just back in time, I remember feeling like, oh, there's just not a lot of that on offer. If I want to fit in, if I want to succeed, then I need to show up in a certain way. I need to have my suit. I need to like speak a certain way. You know, I always sort of internalized early on the ultimate not safe for work content is talking about like family or needs outside of the office. Like, no, you have to show up as always available. And so I like this trend. And when I think about Gen Z entering the workforce, and stereotyping a generation is rough, but like on the whole, like very social and confident in the value of their days, I think this is a really good thing.
I have to wrap this up with a final question about the do nothing days. It's you say it's a strategy for better work, but what does a do nothing day look like that you say creates a lot more creativity?
Yes. So everyone's like, can I have one of those in my life? And it's like, yeah, sure, go for it. So as I define it, I talk about it in the context of work. Sometimes we forget that, especially for knowledge workers, thinking is working. And you know what thinking looks like? It means it's just like sitting there. Like that actually is a legitimate way to spend time working. So quite literally what a do nothing day looks like is an offsite with no agenda, or just a very loosely structured set of prompts. So you could go by yourself, or you could go with your team. Say you're working on some project, or you have some business challenge, or maybe it's you're planning for next year. you give yourself a few prompts, like let's think about how we might want to do this or how we might want to do that. And then you just sort of have a wandery conversation throughout the day where you might literally wander. You might walk in the park. I love a do nothing day at the park. That's what we usually do. You might grab ice creams and walk around town. It's a day to let your brain unravel at its own speed because we so rarely get our best ideas in 30-minute brainstorming meetings. So we can think of it in the same way that you'd think of like taking a shower. Like, why do we get our best ideas in the shower? Oh, well, there's no like digital input. Our hands are busy shampooing our hair. And so we have a little bit of time for our brains to exhale. So you can think of this, it's the same thing, but just in a group and not in a shower.
I love that. Well, we've been speaking with Bree Groff, author of a new book called Today Was Fun, a book about work, seriously, that really does a great job of unpacking this puritanical history that we have about work needing to be painful and shifts to realize that it's about creating value and seeing the humanity in each other. Bree, thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Bree.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Joining us today is acclaimed scholar and biographer Heather Clark, now making her debut as a novelist with her haunting and lyrical new book, The Scrapbook. It's a love story, yes, but also a meditation on historical guilt, moral inheritance, and how the past lives on in the choices we make today.
With a bevy of honors to her credit, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and being named a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, as well as being on almost every books you need to read this summer list, if you're not familiar yet with Heather Clark's writing, it's likely that you soon will be. In The Scrapbook, Clark grapples with epic questions about conflicting legacies, inherited guilt, and writing across time and memory while deeply considering the responsibilities of future generations to reckon with the past. Heather Clark, it's an honor to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So the discovery of your grandfather's scrapbook is mentioned as part of the inspiration for your new novel. Can you tell us a little bit about how it came into your life and your first thoughts about it?
Sure. So I knew that my grandfather had been part of an American army unit that had helped liberate Dachau. His unit wasn't the official liberating unit, but he was in the 86th and the official unit was the 42nd, but he was there and he took photos. He had a camera. So I had sort of heard rumors about these photos and a scrapbook, but I never mentioned it to my grandfather because it was just very clear it was something he didn't want to talk about. And then after he died in 2015, in his 90s, I saw the scrapbook for the first time. My grandmother brought it out after his funeral. And as I was flipping through the pages, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, these horrific photos from the day of liberation or maybe the day after. And these photos just haunted me. And I wanted to write about it in some way, but I was in the middle of writing Red Comet, my Plath biography. And I sort of promised myself that I would go back to this after I had finished Red Comet. So indeed I did.
And sometimes that little period of, I don't know, letting it marinate in the background as you're working on something else, your brain and spirit does funny things to creative works, I think, and it kind of helps them develop on their own in the background. Did you find that using the scrapbook metaphor influenced the way the story came to you? It feels like scrapbooks are kind of nonlinear and full of texture sometimes. And I feel like the book has such a great way of moving back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely. That, the scrapbook as a metaphor was something that really interested me the more I thought about it. And, you know, what do we preserve? What do we leave out? What do we forget? I mean, in a way, we're our memories are just giant scrapbooks, right? We're always curating these things. And so I thought it was an interesting metaphor for the silences that we all have in our families, right? And these questions. And, you know, I had actually started this novel almost 25 years ago when I was spending time in Germany, and I was really unsettled in the late 90s by how few memorials I saw around Germany, especially in the south, in Bavaria. And it sort of troubled me, and I started to write about it, but then I put it aside. Life got busy. I had kids. I had an academic job. I wrote Red Comet. And then when I saw my grandfather's scrapbook, it all kind of came together, and I remembered that earlier manuscript, and I saw a way to bring these two plots together. And yes, I was just very kind of interested in this idea of a scrapbook and how it might influence the form that I wrote in the book, with these dual timelines from the 1990s and the 1940s and fragments of their grandfather's war. You know, you get a little bit, but you don't get the whole story. So yeah, I had this scrapbook metaphor in mind when I was writing.
It's a really good metaphor, the scrapbook. And, you know, especially for our time today, looking at our legacies, there are a lot of conflicting legacies, not just maybe in Germany as you had experienced them, as you say, you know, in Bavaria, when you didn't see a lot of memorials or things like that. Could you talk a little bit about that, about these conflicting legacies?
Yes. Do you mean in terms of my characters? And
well, maybe on a broader, more global scope, because it is a very current topic in this country and probably really has been in Germany since World War II. And in you know, many other countries based on what their histories have been.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was in Germany in the 90s, as I said, there was just a sense of disquiet, right? The war had been over for 50 years and memories were starting to fade, but it was still this long shadow. But a lot of Nazis were beginning to die, right, in the 90s. And that opened up this space for a more honest conversation, right, about the Third Reich and post-war guilt and that sort of thing. And so I sort of feel like the reckoning in Germany really started in the late 90s. And there was much more attention to the atrocities that the regular German army, the Wehrmacht, had committed on the Eastern Front. So my characters, Anna and Christoph, are kind of working through this, this kind of sense of post-war guilt. Christoph's grandfather was a soldier in the Wehrmacht, and Anna's grandfather was an American GI who was at Dachau. So they're kind of coming at these different legacies from different directions, but it's damaged both of them in a way. And I suppose I did want to bring attention to what's happening now, right? On a more global scale, especially in Germany, the AfD is rising again, this kind of far right party that has neo-Nazi links. And we see fascist sentiment kind of on the rise again in many different ways in many different countries. And so, yeah, for me, this was a way of, I guess, bringing attention to that. Like, we're not over it. History isn't over. I know in the 90s, there was all this talk about the end of history. But, you know, I feel like we're almost entering into a new cycle, and it troubles me.
Yeah. The end of history, I don't know where I was in the 90s, but I never heard about that. I mean, I feel like, you know, you always hear history just repeats itself.
Yeah.
And as we know, especially in modern society, how much the pendulum swings back and forth politically, socially, culturally. And I think that's what you're looking at a lot in your book. And I'm interested in how we carry these legacies forward. You know, just it stuck with me when I read Inherited Guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand if your ancestors were Nazis,
yeah,
you know, perpetrating these horrible crimes against other humans, there may be some inherited guilt. But can you go into a little bit more of what you see as inherited guilt, maybe around the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, Germany is a good sort of case study for this kind of thing. And I also want to say that if you go to Germany today, you will see museums everywhere. You will see memorials everywhere. There are what they call Stolpersteins in the ground that mark the last known address of murdered Jews. It's called stepping stones, right? There's a lot of attention now in Germany being paid to the war and the Holocaust. So I feel like they have done a good job sort of reckoning with their past, and they even have a word for it in German, which is Vergangenheitsbewältigung. And it means coming to terms with the past, and specifically the Nazi past. So they've made an effort, and I think that we could learn a lot from them, actually, in this country. And in the book, Christoph says to Anna, I'm giving you a German education, right? He takes her around to all of these German cities like Heidelberg and Nuremberg, Munich, Hamburg, and they kind of go to the war sites together. But he really is, because it makes her think harder about America and what, you know, our sins, our original sins in terms of the way that we've treated African Americans and Native Americans. And so these are larger questions about complicity, and are we responsible for the sins of our fathers and our grandfathers? The two characters in my book talk a lot about this. And I don't know that I have an answer, but I think it's sort of important to ask the questions and just pay attention to our histories and the histories of our grandfathers and our grandmothers. I mean, these histories live inside us, I think, in ways that we don't often understand or give enough credit to. But history is present. It's not just something that's in a faded scrapbook. It's within us every day.
Yeah. Well, that makes me think a little bit about epigenetics, like this fascinating field of study about how trauma can be passed down through generations, even living within our cells, which is kind of hard to wrap your head around, but it's a pretty powerful concept. What are your thoughts about generational trauma as something real and addressable? If we do try to atone for the sins of the past, is that something that is effective?
I've thought about this in my research. I came across studies about children born to Dutch mothers during the hunger winter. That was a winter when the Nazis starved the Dutch population. And there's been a lot of research about epigenetics and the kind of way that those children actually carried that some kind of trauma. I mean, I'm not a doctor, so, but they carried that in their cells, in their genes. So this is a real thing. This isn't just Freudian, you know, psychoanalysis. This is a biologically and genetically proven phenomenon. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think we just need to keep interrogating these histories and trying to understand what they mean, paying attention to them, treating them sensitively, not eliding them, not forgetting. I mean, I think there's a lot of pressure right now to kind of forget about some of the more troubling aspects of our history, and in Germany too, I mean, their history. And we should not do that. And in terms of healing from that, I mean, I think what they have done in Germany is they're on the road to that, right? By building these museums, building these memorials. If you go to Berlin, you see the memorial to the murdered Jews. It feels like it takes up like 10 blocks in Berlin. It's just in the middle of the city. You can't ignore it, right? So maybe that's part of the answer, is just facing this, putting like bringing sunlight to it.
Hmm. Your history or your experience as a journalist led you to write very different books in the past that were terrific, but very different. Did you find that fictionalizing the characters changed your writing process?
Yes. So I spent almost 10 years writing my biography of Sylvia Plath, Red Comet. And I had written a couple academic books before that. I was an English professor for 15 years. And, you know, I had seen a lot of scrapbooks writing my biography of Plath. I had spent years in archives, right? But when I saw my own family's scrapbook, it was such a different experience. I could not assume that scholarly and professional distance that I could with writers like Sylvia Plath. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to write about this in a novel, because it felt too close to home and I was sort of too emotional about it. And I thought, well, maybe I can address some of these emotional truths through fiction rather than nonfiction. And I do think the voice is very different in the novel. I tried to make it more lyrical, more poetic, but one of my challenges was, how do we write about war without sentimentalizing it? And that was maybe one of the most pressing questions for me as I wrote this book. How do we, write about violence and the horrors of the Holocaust specifically without, melodrama and sentiment and that sort of sentimentalizing it, I should say. So that was my aesthetic challenge as I wrote. And I didn't do that, right, with any of my previous books. So this book felt really difficult in a new way.
I bet. You used a word a few minutes ago, interrogating these histories. So it's something about finding this balance between really looking into our histories, interrogating them, and then not continuing to punish ourselves for what those histories are, I would imagine.
Yep.
And I think with so many people these days looking into their genealogy with, things like, I'm forgetting 23andMe, and what is the other one? Oh, genealogy.com. And things like that, they're finding out more about these pasts that they may have, these histories, legacy in their families that are possibly dark. And I'm just wondering how writing this book illuminated or gave you any more insight into how you might interrogate your own past and then heal from it.
Well, a couple things. After I saw my grandfather's scrapbook and I saw what he had seen as a very young man, I had a lot more compassion for him, because he literally stood at the abyss of the 20th century and saw and witnessed the worst things that human beings can do to each other. And we have a frame of reference for the Holocaust now. Those guys didn't. Those young soldiers who went into Dachau and Bergen-Belsen in the spring of 1945, they didn't know what they were walking into. And that is one thing my grandfather always said. He said that we had no idea what this place was. So what does that do to you? What does that do to your psyche to witness something like that, to bear witness? So, and to take pictures as well, to have the presence of mind to take pictures. So I had personally, I don't know, it sort of, it reframed him for me. In a good way, and I think I'm very interested in how we're shaped by our collective histories and our political histories. I think in the long shadow of Freud, we pay so much attention to our personal histories, like what our parents did and how we were raised and our families. But what about the collective histories? What about our national histories, and how do those bear down on us? This is something that my character Christoph thinks a lot about in the novel, and to what extent he's guilty for crimes that his grandfather might have committed during the war. And he's not responsible for that, but I think there's the fact that it's something that he thinks about a lot, and he does feel this kind of inherited guilt for better or for worse. But it's important that we think about it, I suppose, and that we kind of try to face it and deal with it as best we can, and not just sweep it under the rug and sort of pretend this didn't happen. And I've had a lot of conversations after my book events and readings with people who went to Germany in the 90s and Austria, and everybody has their little story about Holocaust denial, right? They're always, I was really surprised by how many people came up to me and said, oh yeah, I talked, so many people said, oh, that didn't happen. Right? That didn't happen. And that's the danger, right? If we just don't deal with this.
Right. Yeah. I'm curious. I've heard that term, Holocaust denial. And I think I've never really looked into what that is, really. Like, how can that be denied?
Yeah, exactly.
Can you explain a little more?
Yeah, well, it's rising. And that was another reason I wanted to write this book. Actually, it sort of pushed me because Holocaust denial is rising. Elon Musk was throwing Nazi salutes not so long ago in Europe. I mean, it's so troubling. I read a statistic recently that I think it was like 45% of people under 30 can't name a single Nazi concentration camp. Like, I feel like this history is starting to fade, and that really worries me. At one point, Christoph says in the book, "We are the last generation who will remember the stories of our grandparents." And so, again, part of writing this book for me was getting my grandfather's story down. And he gave one interview about what it was like to walk into Dachau at liberation. And I put his transcript in the book. I didn't make up those words, and I explain this in an author's note at the end. I wanted his eyewitness testimony to be in this novel. So that was sort of my biographer self merging with my novelist self. So again, it angers me so much that there are these, kind of absolutely crazy revisions of history being touted by fringe elements. But it troubles me that it's becoming a little bit more mainstream. So this book is, in a way, just a very small way for me to push back against that.
Well, it really makes you think a lot about that old adage that those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. As our world seems to become more and more divided in these macro ways. Well, I'm glad you brought up that the authenticity of using your grandfather's actual words in some parts of the book. Was there a lot that you drew directly from the book, or was it more just an inspiring piece aside from that passage, for instance?
I drew directly from the actual scrapbook. I fictionalized it, of course, when Anna finds the scrapbook in the attic. I mean, that wasn't how it really happened. But some of the artifacts that I describe in the novel are real, were actual things I saw in my grandfather's scrapbook. One that interested me quite a bit was this little pamphlet called Special Orders for German-American Relations. And it went out to all the GIs in Europe. And it was basically this long list of don't trust Germans, don't let your guard down around them, they're still Nazis, don't fraternize with them. And of course, a lot of these guys just ignored that, right? They liked the beer. I have pictures in my grandfather's scrapbook of them all drinking German beer, and they liked, I think that they were tired, and they were the victors, and they ignored that. But so they're a little, it was almost like a kind of archaeology going through the scrapbook. It was a time capsule and trying to understand, what his war was like. But yeah, it gave me a lot of inspiration. And again, I'm somebody who, as a biographer, works in archives all the time. So it was meaningful for me to bring my own family's archive into this fictional narrative.
I bet. Did writing the scrapbook change your personal beliefs about war?
That's a good question. As a literary critic and an English professor for many years, this is something that I've thought about quite a bit. It may seem like this book is a real departure for me, but actually it's not. I mean, my first book was about Irish poets in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, the Civil War during the 60s and 70s, and how they reacted to that war as poets through their poetry. And they sort of tortured themselves trying to wrap their minds around these moral questions. Again, how do we write about war without sentimentalizing it? How do we honor the dead? How do we honor the murdered without sugarcoating this violence? And so this is just an aesthetic question I've always been interested in. And so I have my characters discuss it. Like there's a very famous quote by the philosopher Theodor Adorno, excuse me, "No poetry after Auschwitz." And my characters talk about that, no poetry after Auschwitz. Well, is that the answer? Christoph says at one point, no, because then there is only silence and forgetting. But you sort of understand the urge, right? That after something like this happens, we can't have anything beautiful anymore. We can't. So again, I don't have the answers, but it was important for me to just ask these questions. And I mean, war is horrific and hellish. And I think we maybe don't pay enough attention to the way that World War II has shaped our world, even two generations later. I mean, 60 million people died in that war. And I think we're all still swimming in its undertow in ways we don't even really understand, but it's shaped our realities. I firmly believe that.
Hmm. Yeah, there seems to be this very human drive to remember and honor losses through creating, to honor that cycle of life by building from the ashes, so to speak. How do you feel that pain affects the creative process in general? Should we have poetry after the Holocaust?
I have come to the conclusion that we should. I mean, I sort of, that's one of the parts in the book where I put my own words into Christoph's mouth, right? That if we don't, there is only silence and forgetting. So I think we need to bring attention to the atrocities. And when I was in Germany talking about this book, I was actually very nervous to talk about this book in Germany. But that is what some audience members were saying. We need to keep the memory of the atrocities alive. And maybe this is the way to do it, through fiction, through kind of these emotional truths. And a friend said, it's almost like you use the love story as a Trojan horse to get readers to engage with these serious moral questions about the weight of history and inherited guilt and complicity and silence and dark inheritances and all of this. So yeah, I think fiction can be a good vehicle to address those questions, maybe more powerful than a textbook sometimes. I hope so. I think these are important questions.
I think for me personally, it's far more engaging than a textbook. And anytime it asks you to become emotionally involved with a bigger topic than just the love story itself, I think that it lives with us a little bit differently than when we just are thinking about facts. Well, I wish we had much longer to talk with you about this. We've been talking with Heather Clark about her new book, The Scrapbook, that was released in June. And we are just honored to have you with us. It's a fascinating book about the ways that love makes us reconsider the events in our lives and the lives of our ancestors. And it is an honor to have spoken with you. Thank you so much, Heather Clark.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. You can find this episode and past episodes on our website at kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or wherever you find your podcasts under KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you liked this episode, please rate us and share it with a friend. If you have a suggestion for a guest or a topic, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.